For an even better way to listen to Football Weekly at home, at work or on the go, head to soundcloud.com/Guardian Football Weekly or download the SoundCloud app for Android and iPhone.
Football Weekly, all up in that international football edition. Boom, while San Marino massage England's goal stats. For Spain, it's a happy Finnish team after their shock Suomi draw leaves world champions in crisis. We look ahead to the crunch matches in Podgorica and Paris and the inevitable Spain-England playoff. Elsewhere, Wales-Scotland nominative determinism ahoy as Wales' Chris Coleman digs them out of a hole for huge Glasgow win. USA, Clint Dempsey bare-chested in the snowiest game of all time. Brazil, Italy, Simon Cox, Coventry, Southend, West Ham's moves, plus more, including your posts and tweets in today's Football Weekly. Hi, everybody, and hi specifically here, Barry Glendenning.
Hello, James.
Yes, Paul McInnes.
Good day to you.
And bon dia, Fernando Duarte.
Bon dia, Jimbo. Hello, listeners.
Yeah.
Hello, world.
Hello, world. Now, you were just doing a bit of a end of the world as you know it thing there.
Ah, yeah, because you were cramming all those names and all those references and all those jokes into a very long verse.
All of those jokes.
It's almost when Michael Stipe is doing, ah, for me, alternatives. It's almost like a stroke. They did that in Family Guy. The guy has a stroke.
Right. While,
and he can sing the lyrics perfectly after his mouth was all like that. It's brilliant. He's a genius. Seth MacFarlane, I love you.
It's not the end of the world, as you know, but it might be the end of the World Cup, as you know, for one or two nations out there. Ooh. Liking what I did there. And, amongst them, Spain, of course. We're going to talk about that big Spain-Finland game very, very soon. But in the meantime, I'm watching a team practice corners while a stag do plays trumpets in the background. That was Football Clichés describing which match, Barry Glendenning?
I was going to suggest it might be England-San Marino.
Bingo. Bingo. Now, Paul McInnes, you're our delegated England guy. At least the centre-halves got a chance to play together, and when that's the most interesting thing you can say about a match.
Perhaps, yes, exactly. It was played at such a slow pace. I was almost kind of feeling that everything was being played in replay speed the entire time. It was a real training match. The one positive I would take from it is that Ashley Young kind of did something. And also England, for 90 minutes, as they kind of have been doing across this qualification period, pass the ball along the ground.
It's San Marino. Yeah. Who cares? I mean, there's nothing that can be taken out of this game. UEFA should basically tell someone, you know what? Hit the ball. Go and play with it. And now the serious teams, less to the qualifiers. Come on, you know. There's no observations, nothing useful you can take from one of these matches. I mean, not even the fact that Ashley Young resembled a normal football player. I really don't understand why, you know, this is even allowed.
No, I agree with you. It's interesting to see a lot of people climbing on the Football Weekly bandwagon after we bravely threw that idea out there the other day about pre-qualifiers.
I wanted no part of that idea, and I still want no part of it. Well, I appreciate that San Marino don't have much to bring to the international football party. I still find the arrogance of English people, of all football folk, suggesting that any other team isn't good enough to compete on the same level as them.
Well, that's clearly not what they're saying, Barry.
Pardon?
Nobody at any stage came out with this arrogant statement, which you just described to England fans. I've just done the little inverted commas with my fingers, of other teams aren't good enough to compete with them. What they're saying is that there are certain teams who clog up the international calendar and provide no useful purpose. And San Marino isn't the only one. They're not saying they can't compete, just in the same way that League Two teams can compete against other League Two teams, and when they get good enough, they can compete against League One teams. Do the same thing with international qualifiers. They do it in other parts of the world, do they not?
What's the big problem? So San Marino get a tonking. You know, are English players really that busy? They can't find time in their hectic schedules
to travel
to the side of a mountaintop and play them. You know. What else is it?
Some of them are. Rio, for example.
It's not only England. It's the fact that the Andorras are all around there as well. I don't want to be the guy who's going to say, Minos, die. It's not like that. But, you know, some kind of pre-qualification, I think, could work. I mean,
how many teams are we talking about there? I mean, because we're not talking about Montenegro, are we?
We're probably talking four or five of them, one of whom, don't forget, once drew with Ireland in a competitive fixture.
Well, let's move on from the whole San Marino and the pre-qualifying controversy. And let's talk about the next game for England, which you mentioned, Montenegro, looks anything but a pushover, a nation of just 625,000, but that has a considerably better record than England. They won the last four qualifiers. They scored 11 goals, conceded none.
And they have Jovetic and Vucinic up
They
front.
Do indeed. They just won in Moldova. They won away in Ukraine. England could only draw at home with Ukraine. Yikes.
I'm quietly confident that I think in recent qualifying campaigns, by and large, when they've had to get a result away from home, England have done all right. And my constant refrain on England is it's all about the mental attitude towards the game, and I think they need to have their backs against the wall a lot of the time to play half decent.
Right.
And so I will be quietly confident.
Really? Here's Patrick Avenel saying, how come England keep picking proven losers like Gerard, Lamps, Young, etc.?
I saw that. I mean, Gerard and Lamp are proven losers.
But they are internationally, are they not?
Well, yeah, but club not. Right. Club, that's how you pick them, based on club form, isn't it?
Right, okay. Who would you have in your team? Would you have the Ox? Would he be a starter for you?
Yeah, I think. I mean, I would always pick Walcott, but he's not there. So I right. think you might have the Ox in there. He's got a bit of ability. He can beat a man. Has a bit of pace, and I probably play Gerrard and Cleverley in the centre together.
The Montenegro manager Branko Brinovic gave his press conference, or was in the middle of doing his press conference as we entered near Earth orbit to record this pod, but he said England are have always favoured long passes. England are more scared of this game than we are, and I suspect he might be wrong. I have a feeling England will win this game. I'm not sure what that's based on particularly, but I wouldn't imagine the players are too scared. I think if anything they will underestimate Montenegro.
Well, they better do it, because they've already reserved the hotel and everything in Rio, according to The Guardian today.
So. Well, they have to do that, don't they?
I've stayed in that hotel.
Which it's hotel is cool. it?
The Windsor Atlantica.
Oh, that's
it's
nice.
Pretty
is,
posh.
Is that the one closer to the end of the beach?
Run past that many a time.
That used to be the Meridian.
Or jog along.
No, it ain't anymore, and they give you chocolates like twice a day. Once in the morning when they make your bed, and once in the evening.
It's quite anyway, strange how good planning is seen as, you know, oh, such arrogance booking a hotel already. Yes, whereas if they qualify and don't have a hotel booked, they'd be ridiculed for it.
That's not arrogance. It was just a joke about the fact that they picked up a nice hotel that they had to go. Although I must say, that area of the city is very noisy.
Yeah. It's a strange... I mean, logistically, it's going to be a little bit tricky for them, were they to qualify to be based there in Copacabana. No, I'm thinking...
Hey, it's going to be tricky for everybody in Rio.
Producer Ben points out, at least the drinks are free. Copacabana.
Yeah, but that's a patented Club Tropicana.
That's a different.
And you shouldn't drink any drink given to you, because you can get a good night Cinderella. It was basically a good night Cinderella is when somebody passes you a spiked drink.
All right.
You fall asleep and then you wake up somewhere without
your kidneys.
Wallet.
No,
not kidneys. It's usually the money, but.
Right, okay. So, Barry, you're thinking complacency could be England's biggest adversary in this one.
I suspect it might, yeah. I mean, I know England have played Montenegro in the recent past and drawn with them twice.
Yep. With the famous Rooney incident. There's also the away game against Poland, in which England were lucky to get away with a point, would you say?
Yeah, that's the game I watched, and I found them really kind of like lukewarm, something strange. They didn't actually seem to be there in a way. I know that the whole Propil, Proplus gate was going on, but still. I don't know, man.
That's right, I've forgotten about that. Montenegro, let me just remind ourselves that they're top of the group with a far better record. And if England don't win, or even if they draw, although there was the good news about Poland not winning in Ukraine, good news from England's point of view, because that means that, you know, less pressure perhaps for that second place. If England only draw even, then the potential playoffs where the opponents could be, what, Greece, Israel, these are second place teams at the moment, Albania, Hungary, Sweden, Bulgaria, Croatia, and yes, Spain. Sid, Spain, England in the playoffs. It's going to happen.
I know it is.
You know it.
Terrible.
I know it.
What an awful prospect.
Yeah, absolutely. This is all because, of course, the match that you said wasn't going to be a problem, the fixture against Finland. And an extraordinary 1-1 draw. I say extraordinary, but then we see this happening with Spain from time to time. Team parks a bus, Spain can't break it down.
No, I think, you know, any team... I think one of the things that we sometimes overlook is that any team parks a bus and it's difficult for any team to break it down. And we've started to see that a bit in Spain this year with teams finally doing to Real Madrid what they used to do to Barcelona. It's strange that it took them so long to realise that it could be useful against Madrid as well. And Finland, it's extraordinary. I took a photograph at one point of the game, and it was really not a, you know, it wasn't a specific point. It was something that was happening all the way through the game. The two Spain centre-backs, Piqué and Ramos, are only 15 yards outside the Finland area. The entire game being played in almost a 20-metre strip. And it was, Spain found it really difficult to find a way through, but they still took over 20 shots. Finland took one and scored it. And that actually caused a bit of a row between Piqué and Arbeloa over whose fault it was. Which I think might actually have consequences within the national team in terms of the kind of group dynamics.
And Spain, how bad a row was it, Sid?
Well, it carried on for a while. It wasn't just one of these post-goal, oh, you idiot, you should have been here, no, you should have been here, no, it was you. There was that bit, and then there was the next bit, which is 2 or 3 minutes later, and they're still going on about it. And I mean, look, rows on the pitch happen all the time, even with players who are very, very close and who understand each other. But the Spain squad has those fault lines, which I think are kind of a problem in waiting and can be provoked by things like this, not least because then other people sort of turn to take sides. You could talk about this game as being a bit of an aberration and a bit of a fluke, and which to some extent it would be. But it is also true that Spain, I think, didn't create as much as they would have liked. The chances they did have, and they had an awful lot of shots, were not always as clear-cut as they would have wanted. And perhaps they did at times that little bit of variety. Jordi Alba bombing up on the left, but Arbeloa obviously isn't the same kind of player on the other side. They brought on Negredo, theoretically, to give them some presence in the area, but didn't have it. And there are times when you look at Spain and think, well, look, they're a brilliant team, and it's good. The most important thing is they get plan A right. But every now and again, you could do perhaps just a touch of variety and a touch of something different. Taking Oscar Thola at half-time was logical enough, and that's the thing about Del Bosque. Everything he does is logical enough, and in that sense, it's quite difficult to criticise him for it. But maybe by removing the one player who could shoot, they remove the one player who could also force Finland out of their area a little bit.
Mm. Well, a terrific result anyway for Finland, who've never qualified for the Euros or World Cup, and who only had 18% possession in this game. You mentioned Jordi Alba's performance. He'll be out for the France game, but Xavi Alonso will be back, so what do you think, Sid?
Well, it's changed things a little bit in the sense that, and we talked about this, didn't we, in the build-up to this, that the Finland game was seen as an opportunity not only to win, well, that one's gone, but also to get lots of goals and to try and make it so that therefore going to Paris and drawing with France would be enough to keep Spain top of the group. Now, of course, they've got to go to Paris and win. Are they capable of doing it? Yes, there's no doubt they are. And with Xavi Hernandez and Xavi Alonso on the side, of course, they will be slightly stronger. I think the loss of Jordi Alba is significant, particularly in terms of what they're going to do, you know, when they attack, because he's one of the few guys that goes outside and gives them a bit of width. But it's going to be even more significant for Barcelona, by the way, who've got terrible defensive problems at the moment and virtually no defenders left.
Mm. Is it a bit like Barcelona? You know, they needed that wake-up shot against Milan and then they went sailing through after?
Yeah, it's tempting to go for that, isn't it? There might be a little touch of that, and there might be a touch of them kind of playing the Finland game almost as a, you know, that was just kind of something we have to do while we get ready for France.
Mm.
I think it can probably be explained more in footballing terms than that, but it is true that Spain didn't have the kind of the speed and the aggression in the way that they played that perhaps is reminiscent to some extent of what Barca were like before that second Milan game.
Well, the exciting thing is, Paul, yes. Stop doodling, that game, the whole France-Spain thing, wow, what a thing. That's going to be on the same time as Montenegro-England. That's a huge... Which one are you going to watch, Paul?
Well, I mean, I will end up watching the... Actually, I'm going to watch the first two episodes of Season 3 of Game of Thrones, so it's kind of redundant. But when I get out, I will have taped the England game and I will watch that later on.
Barry?
Isn't the Game of Thrones kind of like Hollyoaks with swords or something like that? It just looks the same thing.
Oh, please, do not go down that path, Fernando. We could be here for hours and I will end up handing your arse on a silver platter with a dragon biting it or something.
Wow. Okay, maybe we should go there. But which one are you going to watch, Barry?
Well, I was probably going to watch England-Montenegro, but now I'm aware that the first two episodes of Season 3 of Game of Thrones are available to be seen somewhere tomorrow night.
Do you want to come down?
Yeah, I might go and watch them instead.
All right.
I've never gone to one of these with a celebrity before.
Who's going to be there?
I mean you. Sky Atlantic thing.
Lovely.
But it's on TV.
No, it's a launch thing. It's a preview.
Come on.
I'm working. So.
Mm. I've not seen any Game of Thrones.
It's brilliant.
I surely would. That and the fact you haven't invited me. Just wanted to mention, though, that should you wish to watch France-Spain... you can via the Guardian's website. We're only doing one of our online streaming things.
Is it legal?
Well, yes. Yeah, we got.
All right, cool.
Yeah. We're not some fly-by-night.
Do you get Guardian commentary?
No, I don't believe you do, Saudi, although that's surely the next step.
Yeah, that would be amazing. Yeah.
What's Paul Dwyer for, then? You know, isn't he the French expert? He should be commenting on this game.
Exactly. Live on the website. Anyway, there you go, on Tuesday night. France, of course, doing very well under Didier Deschamps. Three wins in Group 1 against Georgia. That was the last match. Finland and Belarus, plus that draw away against Spain in Madrid. And I think more than good enough to get at least a draw at home and send Spain to a happy playoff.
And a big change of changing of the guard as well. A lot of, you know, Varane and Pogba.
Absolutely.
Started at the weekend, both played well.
Although the player that the papers are most excited about post-Georgia was good old Frank Ribery. They say it's all forgiven, all his past misdemeanours, all his selfish play, even his insurrection in South Africa.
Oh.
He's now playing for the team again, and he's our trump card as we head into this game.
Well, I thought it was Mathieu Valbuena, actually. I mean, he had
the
stormer.
Georgia, yeah.
Yeah, the stormer against Georgia.
Oh, there you go. Quick prediction before we shut this part down on England.
I think 2-1 England.
I'll do Montenegro.
Oh, Barry?
I think England will win.
Right, and what about that France-Spain game?
I think Spain will win.
Really? Fernando?
I think France will come on top.
Okay. Paul?
Another draw.
Another draw.
I actually hope they come on top. I would love to see Spain trouble.
Right, okay.
Of the cult, oh my God, everything they do is amazing.
To be fair, I asked.
Kilo seal and two pandas.
Yeah, okay. Kilo seal with two pandas, did you say?
Yep. Kilo seal and two pandas means like keep on sucking, yeah.
Yeah, keep on sucking, okay. Oh dear, right. Okay, that's time for a little sting, and then we're back with Scotland. Part one was a doozy. And here comes part two. El Popper kicks it off with, love the podcast, love The Guardian. But this total disregard for Scottish football is getting boring. Okay, the top league is dominated by one team who are currently 15 points ahead. But then we have that problem in Scotland too. Ba-dum tish. Check the stats, show a bit of respect to your listeners and readers. El Popper, you're spot on. I can only apologise for our complete...
Why is he spot on?
Because we're pretty... You, for example, were having a gentle dig at Scottish listeners in our last show.
Why? Because...
You suggested they should be in pre-qualifying.
Well, you were the one that said
I didn't
teams
say Scotland.
That clearly aren't good enough to compete right. Should have to pre-qualify.
Right.
Scotland clearly aren't good enough to compete. Did all you right. See their game against Wales?
You did, didn't you, Matt?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. And tell us about that one.
Well, hopefully being kind to these... Scottish people who are desperate to take offence at the slightest joke at their expense. It was a really, really bad day at the office for Scotland, because if that performance is indicative of the state that Scottish football is in, then they should be forced to pre-qualify. They were absolutely appalling.
Absolutely appalling?
Yeah. They couldn't string a pass together. Their tactics, the tackling was at best incredibly clumsy, or at worst just vicious, and they were sent out to do a hatchet job. I hope that's not the case. I don't think that's Gordon Strachan's style, but it's difficult to know. They have some decent players. You know, MacArthur, Alan Hutton, Alan McGregor, Sean Maloney, Stephen Fletcher, Charlie Mulgrew, Dorrins, Robert Snaggart. These are all, they're not world beaters, but they're decent footballers.
Two of whom are going to be missing for the next game. Snodgrass, after he was sent off in this game, and Stephen Fletcher, who picked up an injury for the game against Serbia.
That's probably one of the most notable things to come out of that game, really. Seeing as the qualification didn't really go, it doesn't really affect qualification all that much. Sunderland and their one goal scorer having... You know,
How long is he going to be out for?
I don't know yet, but he won't be.
It will be a minimum of 6 weeks and possibly the rest of the season.
Right. Now, when you switched on, the game had been underway for a bit, but you noticed that Wales were massively on top, in your words, and you noticed also the odds on them winning looked particularly inviting, so you piled on some cash, and lo and behold...
Scotland scored.
Right.
So if I'd kept my powder dry for about 5 minutes, I'd have got much better odds.
Right.
But...
How did they score then, Barry?
Pardon?
How did they score?
They put the ball in the back of the net.
Oh, I see.
And
old school.
Yeah.
Right.
But Wales sort of were a bit rattled briefly, and but then resumed in the second half and just took complete control of the game. And
was the Robert Snodgrass red card, was that the turning point?
I wouldn't say it was the turning point, but it certainly helped Wales.
Scotland were 1-0 up at that point.
Right, what was the turning point, or was a turning point then?
Well, Scotland going 1-0 was completely against the run of play. I mean, it's difficult to put into words just how completely under the cosh they were. And bear in mind, they're playing Wales. Mm. And Wales are not much good either.
Well.
So, but, you know, hopefully this was just a really bad day at the office for Scotland and they're not this bad. Because if they are this bad, then they're in serious trouble.
Let's speak a little bit about Wales. We talked about Snodgrass any of the other key moment, perhaps, was Gareth Bale going off and young Johnny Williams coming on. Now, for the last year and a half, if Bale hasn't scored for Wales, Wales haven't scored. So this is quite a remarkable result for them. And a lot of people oohing and aahing over Johnny Williams' performance, the young Crystal Palace starlet, who people are saying is basically what the new Gascoigne is.
What is it? My Welsh colleague, Gwilym, says that he looks like a Welsh Iniesta. He says he has 360-degree vision.
Wow.
Chris Coleman described it as his team coming of age. And, you know, they were away from home playing in hideously bad conditions, you know, snowing quite heavily. They showed they can win without Gareth Bale because they were a goal down when he went off. He was ill, I believe, and had a virus or something. And, they have every right to be pleased. Neither of these teams are going to qualify and both have a lot of work to do if they're going to be at the business end of any future qualification table, say for Euro 2016.
Right, yeah.
But you're kind of smirking at me here.
No, I'm not. I'm enjoying this. Okay. Good. All right, then. The Welsh are not in the pits anymore, thanks to Chris Coleman. And Margaret Thatcher.
Ooh.
Right, kids. Next up for them, they take on Croatia, who beat the Serbs in that big Balkan derby thing that we were talking about the other day, 2-0. But you knew that already. Ireland drew. Hey, that was a good result, wasn't it? You were writing off their chances, Barry, on Thursday.
I was, and I was wrong, not for the first time. Right. But apparently, it was a good result, but the performance was fairly poor. I don't think Sweden played particularly well at all as the home side. Ireland didn't trouble Isaacson in the Swedish goal once.
Robbie Keane, you wanted him out. He is out. How'd you feel?
Great.
Okay, Austria next. Northern Ireland, their game against Russia was very much snowed off. Next up, they take on Israel, who were 3-1 up against Portugal with not long to go. Portugal roared back to make it 3-3, but they are still in all sorts of trouble, Portugal, third in that group. They're once again doing that really rubbish in the qualifications and then last-minute gasp for a potential playoff. And it's not looking good for them, is it?
It's not looking good, and I assume that, you know, Bento's going to be under a lot of pressure. I was going to say that Israel are notoriously, as we say in Portuguese, beer waterers. I mean, when somebody throws water in your beer, right? Oh. They always do that. I mean, they once basically helped eliminate France for the 1994 World Cup. True. So that's why some teams in European qualification actually deserve to be there. Look at Israel 10, 20 years ago, where they are now.
That just blows your argument out of the water for pre-qualification. You've got to give these countries a chance to grow.
I'm not sure. Are you suggesting that it's a better chance for them to grow, to be continually outplayed at, like San Marino, Kazakhstan are, by much bigger nations that effectively destroy any chance of them winning, or to compete against similarly sized, similarly abilityed nations where they can actually develop a style of play without getting completely starved of the ball for 90 minutes?
Well, I would argue, Jimbo, that rugby union, a game I don't think you're much of a fan of, but teams like Argentina and Italy they were allowed to compete against the big boys, and they've gradually improved to the point where they're now regularly able to beat them.
Yeah, but the point
whereas
about that, Barry,
teams like Romania and Georgia, who aren't allowed to regularly compete with the big boys, aren't able to compete.
All right,
the problem with
that is that there's over 100, what is it, like 150 nations that play football? How many nations are FIFA recognised? How many rugby nations are there, I mean, seriously, that can play in Europe against England and Scotland?
Well, I'd go back to my original point that what on earth, you know, what has England's players so busy that they can't take a time out to
play against
them?
It's not them that's busy, it's the rest of us.
It's the rest of all the teams as well. I mean,
right.
You increase the international calendar, it's already bad for players out there. Whatever you can do for players not to...
Boo-hoo for players. Boo-hoo for these multimillionaire players expected to do the thing they love twice a week occasionally.
I
struggle to do the thing I love twice a week, but that is between me and my doctor.
I'm sympathetic with them, you know.
What are you talking... Yeah. Okay.
I'm sympathetic with the players in this sense, man. You know, it is not like an easy career. They just don't sip champagne all the time.
You're only sympathetic with them, Fernando, because you've just been living like a footballer for the last 2 weeks, embedded deep in the heart of the Seleção as they continue their extraordinary Brazil World Tour, TM. It last time out took them to Geneva for an incredible game against Italy. And next up, you got Russia at Stamford Bridge. Hey, let's talk about the Italy game.
Before we talk about the Italy game, can I just ask a question? And if anyone, if, for example, San Marino came up with the necessary cash to entertain Brazil, I bet you he'd have no objections, or they would have no objections to playing against San Marino or Liechtenstein or any other team of minions who are willing to pay enough money.
Can I defend myself?
That gang of global touring mercenaries.
Right.
The FA would certainly get the cash, and Brazil have played against some horrendous opposition. Yeah. Gabon, like selections of Thailand and that kind of stuff. But it doesn't mean that we don't lambast them in the press. We are absolutely appalled by the choice of opponents Brazil has had in the last 2 years. But and now finally they are lining up big guys. It doesn't mean that I agree with the existence of those teams in big tournaments. But anyway, you asked me about Italy. I mean, it was a great match for neutrals to watch. For Brazilians, it was painful.
Really?
Because we saw a masterclass by Prandelli. Italy had the better of Brazil in tactical terms. You know, they asked a lot of questions the Brazilians couldn't answer. You know, there were two goals, but they were like, let's imagine at halftime Brazil were winning 2-0. That was like the biggest deceiving score of all time, because Brazil scored totally against the run of play. If anything actually went according to Italy's plans, Balotelli would have a hat-trick before the 30th minute. Mm. They actually, they assaulted us for most of the match.
They certainly did.
Worrying, because Scolari had the best that he could get in terms of, like, everybody was fit, apart from Paulinho or Ramirez, but I don't really think it would have made a big difference. So a couple of tough questions asked. And now with Russia, let's all remember that it's Fabio Capello behind, and that again they're going to play against a conniving Italian. So,
all right, well, the Italians very, very happy with the performance, because, of course, they did go down to those two goals in rapid succession just before half-time and then roar back in the second half.
In 3 minutes, the equalising 3 minutes. It was unbelievable. And the Balotelli goal sums up a lot what's wrong with Brazil. Wrong pass by Oscar, unfortunately. It was great, wrong pass. But Balotelli gets the ball 30 meters away from the goal. He has the time to look where he wants to put the ball, make himself an espresso, drink it slowly, and then fire it past Julio Cesar. So why the hell people didn't close him down is a mystery for me, because I think Brazil, of all things, we've been criticizing Brazil for not playing, flamboyant football, etc. Yeah. Now we're criticizing them for not having a proper midfielder enforcer.
To be fair, I mean, he was bursting upfield, and I don't think anyone expected him to score at that point, but a little bit of pressure would have certainly influenced his decision. Brilliant goal from Balotelli. If we're looking for some signs of progress, this is only Scolari's second game in charge. The first one was that defeat to England. The fact that Hernanez put in the middle there, functioning well alongside Fernando, does that...
It helped a bit, but I still don't think we are able to actually, counterbalance the pressure people put on us. I mean, England were pretty much bossing the midfield against Brazil, and with Italy, it was clear that there wasn't a response, especially when Italy switched to a 4-3-3 in the second half. They stopped our fullbacks from actually doing anything. I mean, Alves was going all the time, but Scolari had chosen Atletico Madrid's Felipe Luis on the left instead of Marcelo, so that we wouldn't be surprised too much in counter-attacks. But still, the first half, the combination between Dani Alves and David Luiz was pretty dodgy. I mean, David Luiz playing on the right for Brazil, so that Dante, Bayern Munich Dante, can actually play on the left. Thiago Silva was on the bench because he had just come back from injury, etc. But a lot of my colleagues were thinking, okay, we were asked a lot of tough questions today and we didn't answer properly. Let's see against Russia tonight at the bridge.
At the bridge, as you say, Blue Legend asks, can someone on the pod kindly ask Fernando Duache what Scolari sees in Hulky?
Well, I think he sees Hulky as pretty much everybody else does, as a battering ram, but also a guy who's got a mean foot that can score goals. I mean, I questioned yesterday his decision. I asked him about his decision to go to Russia instead of actually trying to be in a proper league. I mean, in regards of actually more competitive matches and for his technical development, he said that he was happy there. He thought that Russia was getting better. I think he kind of is dropping off the radar a bit. Problem is, we don't have
a player that can actually do that that role for us, and he's quite useful. He's not pretty, but it's useful to have a guy like him around on the squad at least. I have my doubts if he's a good starter. I also have my doubts if Scolari is the right manager, but you know, I've spoken about this story before.
All right, what's going to happen with the team tonight? Will he be in it? Would Thiago Silva be in it? Marcelo? Kaká? Will Kaká be starting after a good performance when he came on?
I don't really think he did that well. I mean, it's funny. Under Mano, when Brazil played without a center forward, and then they had to organize a 4-6-0 thing, the Catalan scheme, as people talk in Brazil. Brazil Catalão, as we said, because it was like almost like Barcelona. Yeah, Messi was there, of course. And he played really well with that, you know, quick link up and no proper number nine, and everybody kind of like rotating up front. It was great. And Neymar seemed much more comfortable with Kaká on the pitch than with Ronaldinho, because both of them seemed to drift to the left too much, you know. And I think Neymar kind of like gets a bit starstruck when Ronaldinho's on the pitch. Having said that, in the formation that Felipe tried, which is a 4-3-3, and he played, he basically replaced Oscar, I don't think it worked.
What's the mood like among the players in the squad then?
You see that Kaká himself is much more kind of like, he's soaking a bit. When he came back under Mano, he was like this blast of joy in the player. You could see that the whole mood in the squad changed, because he's a great guy. He can work a room like anybody. So he started talking to the press. It was this whole thing, oh yeah. Remember, he was the last Brazilian to win the FIFA prize, so people always expect him to some kind of like resuscitate. This time, though, Scolari is giving him a bit of a cold shoulder. Didn't start him against Italy. Didn't call him up for the England game. But well, what can we say? I mean, the squad is pretty much dominated by David Luiz and the Chelsea players. They have a very very strong influence. Thiago Silva is also a big guy, and Neymar somehow is this young kid. I think if they don't win against Russia, they're going to start getting a bit jittery. The Italy game, they were at least happy. Okay, we managed to give them a scare, etc. But you know, there's some tough matches coming around. I mean, there's England in June, France as well. The small matter of playing Mexico and Italy and Japan in the Confederations Cup. It should be a tough test for them.
You should say that David Luiz is the dominant personality in the dressing room.
Yeah, he's the captain. He's the I mean, whenever the guy goes, he's going to take over. See what he did at Chelsea. I mean, this was a guy that wasn't scared of actually confronting the big guys. He had like kind of like you know proper exchanges with Didier Drogba once. He actually tried to correct Drogba's positioning, and when Drogba tried to get big on him, he said, "Yeah, what's up?" It said, "You know,
tried to correct Drogba's positioning on the field."
Yes, no, in a defense situation and a game, he was. He tried to say, "Listen, here." He was trying to correct the defense. I think they were defending a corner or something like that, and Drogba tried to just cast him aside, and he answered back. And this is a guy who had just arrived. So, I mean, but this is also a Lionheart guy who plays a Champions League final with one leg.
Right.
So, all due respect, he's our captain, and I have a man crush on David Luiz, basically.
Okay. It's just fascinating to hear him lecturing another player on defensive positioning, because it's not what you think of as his specialised subject. But, okay, that's it for part two, and very shortly, more stuff.
On the Guardian Audio Edition. Sean Ingle on the Tabata workout programme. Harder, faster, fitter, quicker. Kira Cochrane on the rise of the naked female warriors. And in our audio book review, we look at some of the best new fiction around, from Kate Atkinson and Ruth Ozeki. To subscribe for free to the Guardian Audio Edition, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian or find us on SoundCloud, iTunes and Audioboo. Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Part three, and Fernando, you want to do what?
I want to tell a joke about the Argentine Pope.
How about we save it till the end of the podcast? And anyone who's sensitive to that can leave and walk away, and the rest of us can enjoy your joke about
Francis the First, or just Francis, because you can only have Francis the First when Francis dies and Francis the Second gets appointed. Is it that? That's what the Vatican was saying. Do not call the Pope.
Yeah, I think we'll stick with the joke actually on that. Okay, good. Right. Well, that'll be later. In the meantime, wow, I can't believe there's more international stuff to say. There's stuff about like Colombia doing really well. And hey, how about this? USA with their extraordinary win over Costa Rica. Did you see this?
I just saw photographs where there seemed to be a lot of snow.
The snowiest game ever. It's got to be.
Yeah, it really put those Northern Ireland fellas to shame.
Yeah.
I wonder what the Russians made of that, actually.
I don't know.
They probably thought, what to call this snow?
But it was an incredible match. The visibility was zero, pretty much. They had people out clearing the lines while the game was still being played. And amongst all of this, Clint Dempsey.
Clint Dempsey got another tap-in. After going from last year being the most spectacular goal scorer in the league, is now every goal he scores is a tap-in, it seems.
I tell you what he did that was spectacular. He went around shirtless at the end of the game. How hard as nails is Clint Dempsey?
There's just some of the photos that Barry was saying, some of the photos are just amazing because they just catch these moments of kind of expression when everyone's like slightly bamboozled because they don't know where the ball is and utterly chilled to the bone. Mm. Looks like scenes from like a Cro-Magnon wedding party or something.
Cool. You know what? Tom Loughlin was posting before about the Balotelli goal, saying, how cool is Balotelli and who are the coolest players of all time? I got to say, for me, I've always had Clint Dempsey in there. I mean, specifically in this case, because it was very much...
You've clearly never seen his hip-hop video.
I have. That was on a show that I did. Okay. When Alex Gordon-Martin, who's the young Oxbridge-educated reporter, says, I hear you do a little bit of... You have a bit of flow. You can MC a little. And Clint looks at him like, you don't know what you're dealing with, white boy. And he says, well, actually, I beatbox a little. And Clint increases the sneer on his face while not saying anything. And so Alex starts to bust out a groove, and then Clint lays down some deuce stylings on top. I do urge you to seek it out, because it's a glorious moment. Glorious. What you need to do is Google Alex Gordon-Martin and Clint Dempsey and beatbox. And there you go. Or Satanta, I don't know. Remember Satanta?
I do indeed,
yeah. But the incredible thing, we were just talking about that USA game against Costa Rica, but now the thing is, Costa Rica want to do it all over again. Their FA says that FIFA should take disciplinary action against the CONCACAF commissioner at the match and the refereeing group because they didn't postpone it. There was a bit of a pause around 58 minutes in where they were saying, look, we can't go on with this. And eventually they accepted to just keep playing. But they said it was absolutely ridiculous that they were forced to play in those conditions. It wasn't entirely accidental, USA choosing Denver as a place to stage this game.
But as far as I can see, admittedly from the CNN clipped report, the Costa Rican players agreed to play on.
Well, apparently they did. Brad Guzan had a brilliant game in goal, which can't have been easy in those conditions.
Did they use an orange
ball?
No,
as far as I can tell, they didn't.
No, and
on the clip, you're going to... Yeah.
The clip is brilliant. They've got some American special effects where they kind of do a flame trace trail on the ball so you can follow it around the pitch.
I think it was a special effect. Either that or it's the kind of innovation we'd all like to see.
Oh, yeah.
Flaming balls.
Dragon
in
balls.
Football matches. Cool. Yeah, it looked good, that, didn't it? Mm. Anyway, next up for USA, who are now second place in the hex thing.
I understand the structure.
Yeah,
no need
good.
To explain it to me.
All right, well, they have those six teams and three go through.
So round robin of six teams.
Exactly, there you go. So you've got Honduras atop, USA second, Jamaica, if I'm not mistaken, a third, which means that in fourth place are Mexico, who are currently heading towards... That's who's hosting USA next to the Azteca. That'll be a huge game. Huge.
Oh, and I so hope they lose.
Who?
Oh, Mexico, yeah.
You want Mexico to lose?
Of course.
Why?
Because they've been beating us recently. They are annoying because they play great football. They've got a great league. They're the country of the future. But, oh, come on, man up, you know,
right.
Know how to win as well.
Okay, offend all Mexicans. Tick.
we're turning into top gear.
They just came off a...
You know how easily offended they are. They got really upset over that top gear.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
You're going to have to apologize to all of Mexico.
I apologize in advance to all Mexicans who are actually good winners. They don't just kind of like think that because they win a gold medal, they've won the universe.
Right. Okay, well, they just drew...
sour grapes, yes.
While USA were freezing the butts off, to use the components, in Denver, Mexico, were playing in 107 degrees heat in Honduras. The Hex leaders at the moment, Honduras, 2-2 draw. I'm losing your interest on this, I know. But anyway, Chicharito Brace, he got both goals for them. There you go, they were 2-0 up. And that's a huge game then, because if Mexico stay fourth, they'll have to go into a playoff with only New Zealand.
Only New Zealand?
Only New Zealand.
Well, in fact, only New Zealand.
Well,
who were unbeaten in the last World Cup?
Exactly.
Chris Wood up front and Winston Reid at the back.
All right, well, you know what? Here's Peter Purvis posting in from down in Oceania. He says, we just endured the Battle of Dunedin. New Zealand coming through 2-1 against New Caledonia. He says they were appallingly dirty. Challenges were sickening. New Zealand's Shane Smeltz copped a boot in his face in the 94th minute. Just before Ipswich's Tommy Smith looped a header over their goalie. The ref was a disgrace. South Pacific teams have resorted to rough stuff and against an increasingly New Zealand side. And check out the all-white Marco Rojas, who's coming to a team near you.
See, people from New Zealand always get upset if you accidentally mistake them for Australians.
Right.
But then when they do all that whinging after a sporting event in which they've won, you're bound to mistake them for Australians, aren't you?
Right. Okay, well, anyway, that's exciting then. So New Zealand playing somebody in a playoff, and it might be Mexico or it might be Jamaica. We'll keep you abreast of that one. And that is it for international stuff, but by no means it for this podcast. Come back, producer Ben. We've got more things to do. How about Phil Brown back at Southend?
Yes, and he's welcome back because the football world has been a duller place without him.
Mm-hmm.
But Southend have really shafted Paul Sturrock, who's their manager. Paul Sturrock, who has Parkinson's disease, and who has steered Southend into the Johnson Paint Trophy final against Crewe.
In 2 weeks' time.
2 weeks' time at Wembley. And the Southend chairman, Ron Martin, put an extraordinarily rambling statement up on the club website, which our friend and Southend United supporter Ian McIntosh described as a stream of self-indulgent Brent-like shit. And it's difficult to disagree with any of that, because he sort of puts inverted commas and quote marks in, you know, weird places. And you imagine if he was talking, he'd be doing it like you do, actually, Jimbo. So, you know, making air quotes. And but yeah, it just seems to be a really strange decision. He describes our day out, this is their trip to Wembley. He makes it sound like some, you know, I don't know, a sunshine bus excursion to the zoo or something. And Southend are actually ninth in League Two with 55 points. They're not going to get promoted, but this decision to sack Sturrock seems bizarre.
So he's
particularly, Sturrock's contract expires at the end of the season. Right. He could have just not given him a new one, but he said, no, we need to get a new manager in now so he can see the team in a competitive environment and decide what he needs to do.
But he wants Sturrock to come back and do the Wembley game just as a one-off.
Well, he said he's going to have him lead the team out. Is Sturrock going to manage the team?
He's supposed to be doing it as kind of special guest appearance as manager for all time.
Weird.
So. It is weird, isn't it?
And it also contradicts his... anyway, look, it's... Yeah.
Yeah.
Go to the Southend website and read his statement. It's a good laugh.
All right. Now, in other football news in the last couple of days, you have West Ham confirming their move to the Olympic Stadium.
Yeah.
How do we all feel about that?
I think it's a good move for West Ham.
Is it?
Yeah. A lot of people seem very outraged about that. This they've had this good fortune, but
well, it's not so much that. It's just Upton Park. It's a bit of a fixture, you know.
Well, Jacob, who is our resident West Ham fan, he says Upton Park's an absolute sort of shambles at the moment. It is a bit of a kip, it has to be said, and he said the atmosphere there is awful. So
really?
You're talking about legacy, right? You have a stadium in East London.
Mm-hmm.
West Ham are the East London main team, you know, in the case of their Premiership team.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems logical. It's much better than have a white elephant there.
No,
I mean, and having to reach a decision where Athletics would still be around there. Because look what happened to Crystal Palace before. It's not like there's always been a fantastic legacy, and all of a sudden Athletics are being robbed of a stadium, isn't it? I mean,
no, they'll still use it for Athletics.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's more the fact that we're going to have to pay as the taxpayer, have to pay the majority of the conversion, and they get it all cheap.
Well, absolutely, but if you want to be angry about it, your anger should be directed at Lord Coe and the Labour Party and Ken Livingstone, because it's their fault. They built a stadium without having the foggiest idea what they were going to do with it after the Olympics.
Didn't it happen with Iceland as well? I mean, the Commonwealth Games. I mean, Man City got the stadium the cheapest.
Yeah.
So, well,
why shouldn't West Ham?
Yeah.
Interesting point. A team that could do with the stadium on the cheap, or indeed any kind of stadium, are Coventry, Barry. What's the latest on them and their journey into administration?
Well, it's a very long, convoluted and quite boring story. I have time. But basically, to get the full version, I would recommend going to Duncan Castle's website or the 200% website. They've both written a length on the subject. But basically, I think it was Friday, it looked as if Coventry had done a moonlight flit from their landlords. They owe, I think, £1.5 million in rent. They haven't paid any rent this season. And they were going to basically scarp or leave the landlord high and dry, the owners of the Ricoh Arena, and were hoping to play their three remaining home matches this season at Walsall's Bescot Stadium.
Yeah.
But now it's emerged that an American multimillionaire named Preston Haskell IV has offered to buy a half share in the Ricoh Arena on condition he's allowed to take over Coventry. And he's promised, if that happens, to plough a load of money into the club.
That name again?
Preston Haskell IV. Right. Son Who's of Preston this? Haskell III.
What? Preston Haskell IV is.
Yeah, okay.
What does it do? It sounds like the name of like an old Louisiana rancher, you know.
Well, his father owns a big property company in Florida, I believe.
Right. He's the third, I imagine, isn't he?
He's the third,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, good. All right, well, that might be good news or not, depending how...
Well, it depends. You see, you hear these stories, and it could end up that Preston Haskell IV is actually a 15-year-old kid in Birmingham.
I have to say, the name does, you know, arouse some suspicions in me.
Yeah. Mm. Well, Duncan Castles has written about this in time, and he's pretty on the ball. He's got his finger on the pulse.
All right, on the subject...
My former neighbour, Duncan Castles, yeah.
Okay.
You used to live in the same building.
Really? Yeah. Okay.
Why did he move out, just as a matter of interest, Fernando?
I moved out.
Oh, okay.
When the wife decided there was time for us to try for babies. It was a one-bedroom floor, so it was a bit flat, so it was a bit small.
Okay, similarly financially troubled Dunfermline Athletic, Baldy 3 says, wondering if you could please mention Dunfermline Athletic. We could be going out of business on Monday. 128 years of history. They have a five. Well, it's the deadline. By the time you hear this, that deadline will have passed. 5 p.m. The Pars have gotten to pay. It's only £134,000 worth of tax. They're currently fourth in the Scottish First Division. If it was their last game past weekend, it was Royal Humdinger. They threw away a 3-1 lead at home to lose 4-3 to Dumbarton. Legacy. Right there. Okay, that's about it for today.
We have to talk about Kyron Sidroth.
No, do we have to? I don't think we do.
You've got two things backed up at the end here, and your joke about the Pope.
Yeah, I want to talk.
You should choose one of them.
Yeah, okay, that's a good shout. But before we come to that, I've got two other things to say. One is, we were just in time leaping aboard the Simon Cox bandwagon the other day because he's only gone and won goal of the season at the Football League Awards, Barry.
Yeah,
for an even better one than the one you were talking about against Luton.
Do you think it's better?
I think it is. They're both
very good goals. Right, I don't want to take anything away from.
Okay, that one is the famous one for Swindon against Luton, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah,
yeah. This one is the goal he scored for Nottingham Forest back in September against Birmingham City, which similarly is a long ball over the top. He controls it without letting it touch the floor, chips it up, and then volleys it, but from a much more acute angle. Slightly closer in, but from a more acute angle. They're both brilliant goals. And John Salt says, he posts in with a couple of examples. He says, Simon Cox is a scorer of great goals. He's been trying to best the Swindon effort all season at Forest. He's doing a cracking job. Cracking job. I want to ask you, though, Paul McInnes, what you think about Ricky Van Wolfswinkel.
Everybody has been trying all weekend to try and come up with a song for Ricky Van Wolfswinkel, and nobody can succeed. It's just far too many syllables.
Ooh.
I think he's going to be the first of a lot of glamour signings, not just for the Norwich, although I hope lots for the Norwich this summer.
Right. Is he a glamour signing?
Well, he's a 24-year-old Dutch international, played very well in the Sporting's run in the UEFA Cup last year, has had a mediocre season this season.
Right.
But so are Sporting by and large, and they're in financial chaos, which is why we managed to pick him up for £8.5 million.
Plus, just think of the shirt sales. That's going to be huge.
Well, apparently there's a limit. There's a character limit on that you can get from shoulder to shoulder, and Van Wolfswinkel exceeds it. So
which bit will they use, do you wonder?
Well, I was reading on Twitter, there's three guys who are going to, you know, sit next to each other, and they're going to have Van Ricky. And Wolf and Winkle.
Oh, right.
Yeah. It's almost like Fenegor von Vasselink when he played for...
But with Winkle in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, in terms of the shirt thing, yeah.
They just put vinegar on those, didn't they? Or did they
have V and Hassling.
Don't type Wolf Winkle into Google Images, by the way.
Really?
Yes.
Or Dinosaur Winkle.
I haven't tried that.
All right, because boffins, and I use the word advisedly, have managed to reconstruct how dinosaurs were able to have sex with each other without injuring each other, because look at these stegosauruses.
I always wanted to ask that question. Yeah. How the hell? Man, that must
a
have been some...
six-foot member. That's the answer.
Oh, that must be some loud business, isn't it?
My friend Billy had a six-foot willy, and it turned out he was a diplodocus.
Oh, dear. Anyway, you know what? You might just be stealing Fernando's thunder, because Fernando is going to play us out with a joke. Fernando, let's hear it.
Okay, it's a joke in two parts. The first thing is not a joke. President Dilma Rousseff of Brazil actually wants Pope Francis, the Argentine Pope, to bless the Maracanã Stadium, where the World Cup final will be played, hopefully. Yeah. Haven't they got Messi already? They actually need another Argentine basically casting a spell at our stadium. But anyway, but the real joke is that the whole thing about people talking about Pope Francis or how humble he is, the miracle with Pope Francis is actually that an Argentine accepted working under God. So,
there you go.
And Clarence Seedorf was sent off for the first time in his career.
Yeah, and why? Why was he sent off?
Because the referee told... it was a tough game between Botafogo and, Madureira for the Rio League. And, well, Botafogo winning, Seedorf was about to get off and...
He was being substituted.
Yeah. He was trying to run down the clock. He was on the other side. The benches were on to his right side. And he was close to the lines at the left, and the referee said, okay, instead of walking all the pitch, leave the pitch from the side. He said, no, I'm not going to do that. And he started walking, so the referee said, all right, gave him the yellow card. He shrugged his shoulders and walked out on the referee, so he was sent off. And there's been this outrage in Brazil. Oh, this young referee, he was trying to steal the limelight. No, he's the authority. Clarence Seedorf cannot come to Brazil and think he's in a banana republic. Yeah, I'm just going to pretend I'm ignoring the referee. He was well sent off. So it was a shame that his career had to be, you know, get this milestone, because he had never been sent off in his career, because he was just an arrogant bastard. So
I'm sure that's what everyone will think of when they recall the sort of Clarence Seedorf and his magnificent, glittering career, the time he got sent off for Botafogo.
Yep, absolutely. Well, that's where we're going to leave Fernando Duarte for now. Many, many thanks, Fernando, for coming
in. Always a pleasure. Sorry, I had so many things to say, and I ended up saying them all at the same time. So
no, I bet there was more in there. But also, Paul McKinney's.
Thanks,
lovely
man.
Stuff as ever. Barry, super job.
Thanks.
Thanks, producer Ben. Thanks, listeners. And, hey, enjoy those games. If you want the France-Spain game, it's, as we mentioned, streaming live on the Guardian website. Okay, we'll be back on Thursday. Have a super time till then. Bye.